Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again. And welcome back. And it is now or never. And that debt is fraud. Remember, only when government does things that are enumerated. In other words, government can only legitimately do those things that are enumerated in the Constitution. Anything that they do that has been assumed, that has not been delegated, is fraudulent, is unconstitutional. It is an act where they do not possess the legitimate authority to do. Therefore, it is fraud. Okay, so we need to continue our appeals. I appreciate those who are praying. And I appreciate the prayer circles or the individual prayers. I believe in the power of prayer. And in utilizing that power, as we appeal to heaven, we need to continue to apply what we're learning in articulating the help that we need. We started yesterday identifying clearly how we can create and tie together three very specific issues, actually with, you know, some other overlays, that will actually give Trump the opportunity. If he doesn't do anything else, he will literally place America in a new direction politically if he restores one thing about the Constitution. And it serves him and it serves his interest and his agenda, because there's no doubt in my mind he's absolutely frustrated that the court wields the power, this unconstitutional power that they do. The problem is the lawyers that work for him aren't willing to hack away these legislative powers from the judiciary. Because why? They're a part of the judiciary. They're all, if you're a lawyer, you're an officer of the court. As we, you know, dive through this today, we're going to keep pushing forward and kind of laying this all out. But this is all about full compliance of the Constitution. And so when we look at the power of the president has unquestionable the authority to enforce the laws of the Union. In other words, his responsibility is to ensure that the Constitution is being properly executed. Therefore, if the court, if the federal court is failing by, or actually violating the Constitution by actually creating legislation, and Congress has done nothing, and as a matter of fact, it seems, because he's inherited a position where the presidents of the United States have actually encouraged, I'll just say, political activism by the bench. Now, in the very beginning, Thomas Jefferson was, you know, he was very upset with what Marshall was doing, and he spoke out a lot about that. Madison was the same way. Hamilton, Hamilton was a different man who had completely a different vision, and he was a soothsayer. He spoke out of both sides of his mouth. And so we'll get into this a little bit later. Let's just get me through the obligatory. So I'll try to avoid any rat holes. So the whole point is that we have to focus on full compliance with the Constitution. In this particular case, it helps everybody when we really look at the whole scope of the damage being done. This includes the invasion. This includes how the court has been, you know, basically violating the Constitution in so many different ways, as well as the political structure. And so with the court itself, the court has done so many things that have been subversive and so negative on America that I think Trump can actually, I don't want to say, you know, use a reset button, but what he can do is he can basically call them out and they can begin to actually dismantle all of the messes and problems that the courts have created. Now, we're going to get into Alexander Hamilton and James Madison, because these two men, at a very for a very short period of time, worked together. The character of these men were night and day. So, as we kind of wrap up the whole focus of Republic Review, the whole focus of Reclaiming the Republic, is educating and helping everybody do what they can and obligated, they should do by getting compliance to the Constitution. Now, let's dive back into where we were talking yesterday. So we were talking about, you know, all of these different issues, because Trump has been, the court has been nothing but a, I'll just call it a hostile combatant with him trying to actually execute. Now, I've already basically identified that whoever wrote his executive order regarding handling the invaders and so forth and talked about they mislabeled this, you know, the court in their ruling regarding, you know, invaders and so forth based on the Civil War. And in other words, what it was Dred Scott. They had a sub-reference in one of the executive orders regarding Dred Scott that, you know, the court, they felt that the court was, you know, wrong. Actually, they were wrong in making a jurisdiction over slavery and citizenship. The court, if you really look, there is nothing in the Constitution to grant the court to be able to block blacks from being citizens. As a matter of fact, blacks were being admitted as citizens well before Taney even was born. And if you look at the beginning of the, you know, from the Revolutionary War after the Constitution was ratified, there were plenty of blacks that were actual citizens. They were citizens of the United States. Racism started affecting them after the 1800s because they were basically becoming systematically disenfranchised in New York and everywhere else. So when Taney came along and said, well, Dred Scott can't be a citizen because he's black, there was no constitutional founding in that. And so the Trump, whoever wrote that for Trump, was academically and constitutionally wrong. Taney violated the Constitution by injecting that opinion that he couldn't be a citizen. Therefore, his biases basically kept him from doing the right thing in allowing Dred Scott to be a citizen. So, as we look at the court itself, the court has aggrandized long before Taney. And so how did we get into this? And this is where we have to look at the very beginning when this fixing of the Confederation was the topic du jour, where we needed to get away from the Articles of Confederation or fix them. And the only way we could fix them is by getting away from them. In other words, if you're only going to amend the Articles of Confederation, and one of those amendments is to change the acquiescence, in other words, what it takes to ratify 100% of the states, that right there is the dead pill. That right there is the poison that is killing and was going to kill the Confederation. Because as long as Rhode Island existed in the Confederation, they would continually vote no. So it was done. Rhode Island was basically saying, we're going to starve you, we're going to kill you, we don't care about you. They were that hostile towards the Union. The smallest, most insignificant state in the Union was literally that belligerent. They, back in their day, they actually referred to Rhode Island as Rogue, R-O-U-G, it's Rogue. Anyway, I know somebody's going to get my spelling on it. But the pronunciation is Rogue, not Rouge, but Rogue. Rogue Island was the term, because they were literally belligerent towards the laws and in trying to keep a harmonious union. They were very self-serving. Yeah, everybody's self-serving, but they were very self-serving. So, anyway, you know, I don't do prep. When I do these shows, I basically have the outlines of what we need to cover. So that way I don't worry about the spelling. So when I actually try to do that, I should have looked that up. Nevertheless, because when I'm thinking, I've got 20 other things on my mind. Now, Madison and Hamilton, during the Annapolis Convention, agreed they needed to convene a convention to really fix and rewrite the Articles of Confederation. And that's technically exactly what they did, because they took the same language out of the Articles of Confederation and put them into the Constitution, but they changed the structure of government. They did quite a bit. Now, during the Constitutional Convention, because we just covered this past few months ago, Madison came up with the Virginia Plan. The Virginia Plan was basically a new form of government that was going to literally create three branches, but the states would be more administrative. However, it was to make sure that there was no king. It was going to be an elected official, you know, no lifetime appointments, that type of stuff. There was going to be a Senate, a House of Representatives, and a separate judiciary. And the states were really became more administrative, and that the government and representation was based on population, not by state or sovereignty. So that's what was presented by Governor Randolph during the Constitutional Convention. And it wasn't too different from what Hamilton proposed. Now, the New Jersey plan basically came back and said, no. We don't want to do that at all. We just want to, you know, make some amendments to the Confederation. And basically, it was literally doing nothing, keeping the status quo. And then Roger Sherman, I think there was one other plan, but then Roger Sherman, the Connecticut plan, came through in the compromises, where it identified the necessity of doing things. And actually, it was Roger Sherman that basically took the bicameral legislative body away from an aristocracy and people, you know, representation of the people and a representation of the aristocracy, basically the upper class people, than in America. The Roger Sherman basically said, let's make republicanism in America based on sovereignty. Now, he didn't say these words because what Madison wrote down didn't capture this. But the spirit, when you really look at the design of why do we have states' suffrage in the U.S. Senate, and why did we have county suffrage in the state senates? This is because when we create a government, we delegate to that government specific powers. And because that government has been delegated power, that means it is sovereign over powers delegated. Clearly, the federal government is sovereign over war, fighting war and ending war. The states can't do it, the people can't do it. If everybody could declare war, we'd all be in trouble, right? We'd be thrown down every day. So as we look at this new framing, this new concept of republicanism, no other nation ever copied this. This is why it is so unique in recognizing the sovereignty of the governments that people create. In other words, when we look at the county governments, even though we fail to really delegate the powers to them, they did have a place in sovereignty, and they were placed in the state legislature in the Senate. Their representation was in the Senate, where their suffrage was to be met there. In other words, the county legislators, your commissioners or supervisors, whatever you call them, your county legislators had suffrage. They had a representative that they were to work with, and that representative was to vote the way they wanted them to vote.
So, and it's the same thing in the House of Representatives at the state level. They're supposed to, but keep in mind that your state government, just like your federal government, has very defined, limited roles, responsibilities, powers, and so forth. If it is not delegated to them, they can't even, they're not supposed to introduce a bill in granting them new powers because the bill can't stand. They're basically doing something they have no delegated power for. But that didn't stop them. Even though, you know, a long, long time ago, we all understood that they had delegated powers. Over time, the party convinced us, the Uniparty convinced everybody, that as long as the Democrats and Republicans agree, that is, if you have a majority of votes to create something, then it's legitimate. Because your representatives have the power to just do anything and everything you want them to do. In other words, they've basically told you that the Constitution at the state level doesn't matter. It doesn't matter what limited powers you gave them. They can assume unlimited powers, just like the federal government has been assuming unlimited powers as well. Folks, the sooner you get this through your head, that we have to look at what powers they have, and then we have to challenge some of the powers that they have, because many times the states have actually modified the Constitution because the federal government came down and said, you need to do this. And ergo, yea, verily, verily, they wrote it into the Constitution of the state because the federal government told them to do so. They didn't need to go through the amendment process, as near as I can tell. There's nowhere in the federal constitution that states that the federal government could actually amend state constitutions. Let's look back. Let's look at the constitution, and we're reading the ratification debates currently still. We're still covering the ratification debates of North Carolina, one of the last states, because we covered all the other ones. Was there any hint whatsoever or inkling that this new federal government would be able to inject itself in any form of governing the political architecture, the structure of a state, or anything like that? In other words, did the federal government have the power to turn right back around once the Constitution was ratified? Did they have the power to turn right back around and go, okay, unscrew up yourself, you know, go fix yourself now and actually model yourself exactly the way we are? Because I'm telling you, if that was in the Constitution, if the concept of the states having to configure any form of government to accommodate the federal government, if that was in that Constitution, because it's not, the states would have rejected it immediately. They were very happy with the state government. The only thing that the federal constitution did was it empowered them on taxation to be able to actually go and use coercive power to take money if they needed money, to fight war, to do those very few things that they had the responsibility to take care of. In other words, the federal government was sovereign over those things enumerated, and that's it. So they had no authority over the states at all. And as a matter of fact, we covered this painstakingly in the how it evolved in the Constitutional Convention, because Madison covered it in his notes, how new states would be joining the Union. Because remember, I said this several times, that when a new state was going to join the Union, the original idea from the northeastern states and the southern states, they wanted to basically take away or reduce their sovereignty so that they wouldn't have equal power and equal footing. In other words, these would be second-class states that would be joining the Union. That didn't bode very well, but it took a while to change the consensus of the convention, because that premise was still being pushed. We still want to have them, you know, a diminished sovereignty. The concept of equal footing, equal sovereignty, and equal independence came in August. So it was like in the third month, well into the third month. And it would, the real reason for this was actually because the smaller states started recognizing it was pretty hypocritical that as a small state, we're demanding our full sovereignty and being recognized for our full sovereignty. However, we're adding this state to the Union, and this state is actually going to be subjugated to, you know, it's going to be a bigger state. Like, let's look at Illinois, or, you know, because Illinois, shoot, the population, by the time it was coming into the Union, I believe Illinois was going to out-populate. In other words, they'd have more people in Illinois than in Delaware. But Delaware was going to have superior legislative power and representation, and, in other words, not being equally footed. So what they all agreed on was each state was going to join the Union with this exact same status. No diminishment. Federal government cannot hold back any land. That is all your land. Those are your resources. Those are your people. And you have the full cognitive authority to do what the people want you to do. You create your own constitution. The only requirement, is to be Republican in form, not a particular form of Republican, that they just had to be Republican in form. Why? Because all of the original states had different forms of Republican forms of government. We've already gone through this in the Massachusetts and the Virginia ratification debates. They called out the differences of the legal systems between the states as well as the form of government between the states. And it didn't matter. As long as it was Republican in form, the federal government was there to support the states and what they needed them to do. In other words, the parents were the states. And so every time a state joined the Union, they were basically making a joining to a compact, one to many. In other words, when Ohio joined the Union, or Louisiana, foreign territory, a bunch of foreigners being injected into the United States, I mean, these people were given equal footing. Where Indiana didn't, but the point is that, you know, this was foreign territory, foreign land, and all of a sudden it's becoming a state. They probably still spoke French and Spanish and all the different dialects down there. The point is that they had full sovereignty. The federal government had no ability to affect them and take their land from them, only over those things that were enumerated in Article 1, Section 8. In other words, the only property that the federal government could actually pursue and have in the state of Louisiana when it was added to the Union was it could have forts, magazines, needful arsenals, dockyards, and needful buildings. So if they were going to have a dockyard in the state of Louisiana, then the federal government would have to go and pay the state legislature on whatever price they said, well, you're going to take this port, you're going to have to pay us this much for it. And there we go. And then that fort and that little piece of land was either leased or paid for or what have you. And that's it. They can't buy land to sell so that they can sell to private, you know, investors, immigrants, or what have you, so that they can make money off of state land. Once that state became a state, they could not sell another acre. The Constitution gave them no authority, only while they were in the territory status. That's why it stated in Article 4, Section 3, that the Federal Congress shall have the power, and as a matter of fact, might as well read it, because it's important to get this accurately right. So when we look at Article 4, Section 3, the second clause, the ancillary clause for this responsibility, the stewardship of Congress admitting new states into the Union, they have these ancillary powers, additional or secondary to this responsibility. The Congress shall have power to dispose of and make needful rules and regulations respecting the territory. So once it becomes a state, they don't have any ability to dispose of or make any needful rules and or regulations for any of that land. And as a matter of fact, that's why you go to Article 1, Section 8, and says if they want to have a fort, even if they built the fort the first time in the territory, once the state stands up, they take ownership of it, and the federal government has to buy it from them. That's right there in Article 1, Section 8. So we're diving into some more details when we come back, because we need to help you understand how it all connects.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the republic review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you. As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416.
Okay, so we've got to make a very decent, because I've never done this, other than I've said, and I've taken my swipes at Alexander Hamilton for very specific reasons, because, you know, when people say something, you want to take them at the word, right? But what happens when all of a sudden you contradict yourself? Hamilton became a living contradiction from probably the Revolutionary War. Every time he was engaging in government, it seemed like the next step, once he got to one point, there was another, you know, another shoe was going to drop. In other words, the indications were when he said, I need to do this, there was always something else he was holding closer to his vest, like another card, another shoe to drop. So going into the Constitution Convention, because we just mentioned the Annapolis Convention, that there seemed to be this genuine need by both Hamilton and Madison to make a compelling case that the states needed to create a Constitutional Convention. I believe, and I am proposing to you, that I think Hamilton wanted to go in and undo not just the Articles of Confederation, but undo the independence of the United States. Because everything he was saying, once we get into the Constitutional Convention, was absolutely contrary to actually fixing the Articles of Confederation. And he proposed, remember, we read his plan. We read what he proposed. And so I want to highlight some of those things. But before I do, that's why I mentioned that Madison's plan was to actually kind of create this new form of government. Hamilton wasn't in favor or even keen on that new form of government. And so he basically kind of laid out, you know, what he thought, because he was so much smarter than everybody. That was just definitely one thing that you could say about Hamilton. His arrogance was overwhelming. He had enough to fill every room. So one of the things he threw out there was he basically wanted to make sure that this new federal government was going to consume the states. I mean, literally, they would basically be, you know, melted into and subject to this new national government. And so this is one of the lines he says, the general power, whatever it be its form, if it preserves itself, must swallow up the state's powers. This is his proposal of this new government. Going on, he talks a little bit more about what is the best form of government. This is what he says. He was sensible, Hamilton was sensible at the time, that it would be unwise to propose one of any other form. In his private opinion, he had no scruple in declaring, he had no reservation in declaring and supporting, as he was by the opinions of so many of the wise and good, that the British government was the best in the world, and that he doubted much whether anything short of it would do in America. This is Hamilton basically lecturing everybody after all of these plans were proposed and the Connecticut Convention, or I should say the Connecticut Compromise, what Roger Sherman proposed, seemed to be very agreeable to everybody. And Hamilton, you guys are getting further away from the government we need to have. We need to have a monarchy. So actually, he goes short a little bit of talking about a monarchy. But he says, let the executive, this is again Hamilton, let the executive also be for life. Yes, if all the magistrates are appointed and vacancies are filled by the people, or a process of election originating with the people, he was sensible that an executive constituted as he proposed would be in fact but little of the power and independence it might be necessary. On the other hand, appointing them to 7 years, which was the original plan, what they were talking about doing, he would basically then be more enticed of, you know, doing things because he had to worry about getting reelected. And so one of the things he kind of goes down, and I'm just going to read these little highlights, because again, this is a part of his paradigm. The legislature of the United States to have power to institute courts in each state for the determination of all matters of general concern. In other words, he was going to create a judiciary that would go into every state and basically cover all matters necessary for the states, subjugating the states through the judiciary. Sound familiar? He also stated that all laws of the particular states contrary to the Constitution or the laws of the United States to be utterly void, and the better to prevent such laws being passed, the governor or president of each state shall be appointed by the general government and shall have a negative upon those laws about to be passed in the state of which he is the governor or president of. He also went down this point of saying, no state is to have any forces, land or naval at all, and the militia of all states to be under the sole exclusive direction of the United States. In other words, completely contrary. Do you see what this is? Hamilton's proposal. So a wise man is always open and objective and sees the merits in, you know, these other ideas. Madison, you know, to be clear, Madison had a plan, and that plan was delivered by as the Virginia plan. And Madison was, the plan was kind of shot down. Actually, it was agreed upon with the twist of the Connecticut Compromise, okay? So Madison's plan kind of prevailed, but it really didn't. I mean, it changed in so many different ways that, you know, he could have easily been, you know, what's the best way of saying this? Have writers, you know, bias. In other words, because it wasn't identical to what he wanted or didn't meet what he wanted, then he was going to become an enemy to it. There are people that do not like others' plans. And I don't know how they get into these conventions. They get into these positions where they're supposed to work together to come up with the best solution. But instead, they're actually hostile. They're actually contrarians. They actually only see things the way they want to see them and only promote their own ideas. And if they don't get their way, then they do everything they can to undermine you. That's Hamilton. Because when Hamilton submitted his plan, as if I remember correctly, he had to wrap up and head up to New York. And I believe by that point in time, there was nobody from New York at all in the convention until Hamilton came back. So he had to go up and deal with some business. But what business was that he needed to deal with? I'm going to present to you, I believe that he was actually working with, Hamilton was the busiest guy in the Union. And what I mean by that is he had irons in every fire. In other words, he was a mastermind manipulator and a guy that was in the background trying to pull strings and getting his own agenda done. He was networking. He was creating alliances with those people who he thought he had alliances with. And so when He believed he had an alliance with you. He was very honest in his communications with you, which is why I believe he really thought that he had an alliance in in James Madison. Excuse me. I believe that when you really look at the letters he was writing James Madison after Madison returned from New York back to Virginia in early March so that he could actually do a campaign to get elected to go as a delegate to the Constitutional Convention. So he actually started sending letters in May, and we kind of covered those letters. And as a matter of fact, I guess the best thing I could do is probably pull up one of those letters between Madison and Hamilton. And if I remember correctly, I want to say it was somewhere around maybe this one here. So as we look at these different letters that Hamilton was basically sending, I think this is it right here. This is the one where he asks, he mentions in this letter to Madison, I request you to dispatch an express to me with pointed orders. In other words, emphatic, pointed with feeling, right? Emphatic orders to make all possible diligence by changing horses and etc. All expenses shall be thankfully and liberally paid. That right there is Hamilton telling Madison that as soon as he thinks that the Constitution is going to be ratified, that he wants him to dispatch this. And so let me read the beginning of the paragraph, because now you understand the context. We think here that the situation of your state is critical up in New York. Let me know what you think of it. What you think of it? I believe you met nearly at the time we do, or they're meeting about the same time. It will be of vast importance that an exact communication should be kept up between us at that period. And the moment any decisive question is taken, if favorable, in other words, if they're going to take action and it's going to be favorable in ratifying, he requests that he dispatch this pony. He basically gets a rider and gets it up to him so that he's the first to know. Why? Why? What was he doing? Well, obviously, he was in the midst of the New York ratification debates. Was it early June? I think they started in June 26th. So he actually had a little time by the time he received notice from, I think, Gary Elder. Was it Jerry? No, it's Gary. Gary Eldridge. And so Gary Eldridge sent him a notification that, and I mentioned this earlier, that New Hampshire was going to rubber stamp because they were a small state and that the Constitution would protect their independence and their sovereignty, that they were ratifying the Constitution. In other words, to keep this very clear, folks, these small states were guaranteed that the federal government had no control over how they were formed, what they were doing, as long as they were Republican in form. That's the only thing that mattered. Not how they were to configure themselves Republican in some one way or one fashion or another, however they wanted to split the hair, as long as they were Republican in form, there was no problem at all. So, and this is important because this is where the Supreme Court stepped in and they said, your Republican form of government is completely unacceptable. It's too much like the federal government. And we want you to actually change into a democracy. This is why we're doing this. This is why we're making this academic case so that Trump actually understands how maniacal and how evil the courts, the federal courts, have been acting as soon as they got out of the bottle. As soon as the genie got out of the bottle, it started exercising all sorts of powers to ingratiate itself and actually probably corrupted the rest of the federal government. As they were doing this, they're going, you know what, wow, we could create this mutually benefiting relationship and opportunity between us, and we can take over everything. And that's what they did. And that's how they've done it. They didn't do it legitimately. There's never been a legitimate way of putting them into these powers that they have, other than an amendment to the Constitution, which is the way they've never followed. They have never used an amendment to actually aggrandize themselves. They've just assumed it. because they were getting away with it all the time. So why not? Why not continue to abuse and basically bypass and shred the Constitution? Who cared? Anyway, so Hamilton laid out his piece, right? Everybody knows this, and we're going to be covering the Assumption Act in detail. We're going to cover the Bank Act in detail. So as Hamilton actually covered the ratification debates, and so what I'm going to attempt to do right now is I'm going to actually open up the ratification debates, and I'm going to actually provide you with the with a couple of Madison's assertions in the ratification debates, right? So as it's asserted in the ratification debates, that means that these things are legally binding because at this point in time, the individuals that are actually testifying in the debates are under oath. When they were writing the Federalist Papers, was there any applied oath to the authors going into the newspaper? No. And we'll get into the intent and everything else. But when Hamilton was basically making assertions, this is one of the things he said. This is in the ratification debates. This is Hamilton under oath. From the competition that ever subsists between the branches of government, the president will be induced to protect their rights. Whenever they are invaded by either branch, on whatever side we view the subject, we discover various and powerful checks to the encroachments of Congress. The true and permanent interest of the members are opposed to corruption. Their number is vastly too large for easy combination. The rivalship between the houses will forever prove an insuperable obstacle, the houses being the states. The people have an obvious and powerful protection in their state governments. Should anything be dangerous attempted, these bodies of perpetual observation will be capable of forming and conducting the plans of regular opposition. Can we suppose the people's love of liberty will not, under the enticement of their legislative leaders, be roused into resistance and the madness of tyranny be extinguished at a blow? Sir, the danger is too distant. It is all beyond all rational calculations. So in other words, there's just really no way that Congress was going to, the government was going to be able to be tempted to get outside of the boundaries of the Constitution. He also talks about checks and balances and so forth. But let me see here. He talks more about checks and balances. What I want to see, here's one about encroachments. The states have no constitutional control, would soon be found unnecessary and useless, and would be gradually extinguished. When this took place, the people would lose their liberty and be reduced from condition of citizens of that of subjects. It had been remarked that there were more than 2,000 state representatives throughout the Union, and that the number of civil and military officers of the establishment would far exceed those of the United States, and these circumstances, it has been said, would create such an attachment and dependence on the state governments as would give them superiority over the general government. But, said he, were the states arrayed in all the powers of sovereignty, could they maintain armies? Had they been unlimited power of taxation? There was no comparison, he said, between the powers of the two governments. The circumstances the gentleman had enumerated, which seemed to be in favor of the states, only proved that the people would be under some advantages to discern the encroachments. Congress, and to take them, encroachments of Congress, and to take alarm. But what would this signify? The gentleman did not mean that the principles should encourage rebellion, whatever resource they had, none but to wait patiently till the long terms of their senators would expire and elect other men. All the boasted advantages enjoyed by the states were finally reduced to this. The gentleman had spoken of an enmity which would subsist between the general government and the state governments. What then would the situation be of both? He wished, he said, was to prevent any enmity, but giving the states a constitutional peaceable mode of checking maladministration by recalling their senators and not driving them into hostilities in order to obtain redress. So in other words, being able to recall them. In other words, pulling them back as far as the senators go and so forth. Hamilton talked a little bit about the Necessary and Proper Clause, and he says, in the preamble, the intent of the Constitution, among other things, is declared to be to provide for the common defense and promote the general welfare. And in the clause under consideration, the power is in express words given to Congress to provide for the common defense and general welfare, close quote. And in the last paragraph of the same section, there is an express authority to make all laws which shall be necessary and proper for carrying into execution this power. Ah, but he says this power, and he's using a quotation. Actually, it's the foregoing powers. And so this is where Hamilton starts kind of perverting. And where are we? This is June 26th. So they're very early in the beginning of the debates here. And he talks about, let me see. Hamilton, Supreme, taxation. He talks, Mr. Treadwell, martial law, exclusive legislation. Where is Hamilton? Does Hamilton say anything more? I wanted to think that he actually said some greater checks and balances and so forth. Checks and balances here. So there's some another couple paragraphs. What I'm basically trying to prove to you folks, when you look at how Hamilton stated things in the Federalist Papers, he was far more assertive. It was far more aggressive in saying no, because what were they? When we look at these things, what were they? The Federalist Papers were just editorials in a newspaper. Here he's bearing testimony. As a lawyer, he clearly understands the difference of editorializing your opinion and actually bearing testimony. So you could tell that what Madison was saying in the Federalist Papers versus the milquetoast that he was offering in the New York debates was clear. He wasn't trying to be too firm so that everybody would, you know, have this, you know, this big suspicion or have this, you know, clarity of what Madison or Hamilton said. If Hamilton maintained vagueness and Virginia ended up ratifying, then New York, we knew New York was going to ratify. Didn't matter what he said, New York was going to ratify. It was done. Therefore, all he had to do was maintain a level of vagueness with firm assertions. Not hard, aggressive, just some firm assertions that, hey, you know, this is a good government. It's got checks and balances, but he was still misspeaking when it came down to the general defense, welfare, necessary and proper clause, all of those tying together in some just in some weak reference, and instead of really clarifying it as it was clarified in all of the other debates. Was it contrary? No. It just wasn't as strong and or assertive to say that they can only make laws to basically carry out the aforegoing powers. Did he basically mention that there were general powers? No, he didn't. So the bottom line is, why is Hamilton doing this? Why was he acting the way he was through these different steps? He was doing what was necessary. First off, in the convention, that was a closed convention, he felt free to basically say how much he admired the British government. It was the best government in the world, and that's the kind of government we needed to model ourselves after. And, oh, by the way, why don't we just attach ourselves back to Britain? Why don't we just pull ourselves back in there? Right? I mean, that's where his head was. So going into the ratification debates, he just needed to get this done because he already had and was already concocting and exercising a plan differently. So when we look at what he was saying here in the late June, because this is June 26th, June 24th, what was the first day that they were meeting? June 20th. So he had already written the first Federalist paper for the judiciary of June 14th. And as I look, at the Federalist paper spreadsheet, and I go through the dates of Hamilton's Federalist Papers, I can clearly point to you how the 14th of June was the first one under the wire, tucked in, nobody read it, nobody knew what it said.
The next one was June 18th. The next one was June 21st. In other words, this last one, the third one, I should say, was going out when he was just going into the ratification debates. Then he continued on June 25th and 28th. And then on July 2nd, another one. All of these are concerning the judiciary. So, folks, what I'm going to do, and I'm going to try to get it done this weekend, is I'm going to write a very clear and concise article how Hamilton deliberately poisoned, he entered these poisonous Federalist Papers, basically speaking of powers that were not delegated to the judiciary in the Constitution. And as they use the Federalist Papers, they use those Federalist Papers as the justification to, for the courts to be able to do these things. In other words, yeah, use my rules because my rules will allow you to destroy the, I'll just say, the checks and balances that are placed within the Constitution to protect the states and their sovereignty. And that's exactly what happened, folks. So, this is the ground zero for how the federal courts were going to go outside the boundaries of the Constitution and literally do things they had no enumerated authority to do, i.e. interpret the law, i.e. Judicial review, being able to reach down into inferior courts and then be able to create law and be able to actually inflict laws upon the states and subjugate them. And that's where they are today. Now, Newt Gingrich kind of talked a little bit about this. He talked about, you know, how our forefathers distrusted judges and the legal system. I mean, even the Bible, Christ talks ill about lawyers. So, and I would wonder why a Christian today would actually want to take up that profession. Maybe they think that they can bring honor amongst that. You know, but the bottom line is the honor amongst thieves is the honor amongst thieves. When you have to, when your job is to actually twist and undo law and or pervert law, then how can you make, you know, how can you make those dots meet to say this is a good, I'm doing a good thing here? No, you're serving yourself, you're serving an agenda, but you're not doing a good thing because the law is the law and the supreme law is the supreme law. And when you assume the authority to redefine the supreme law to make it something different than what it was defined to be, now we have a problem. See? So this is how Hamilton basically gave the Federalist Papers to John Marshall. This is why he did this, and why John Marshall basically obviated and said, moving forward, we don't want to have any words of the ratification debates in our halls of justice. It's going to come from the Federalist Papers because the Federalist Papers support our aggrandizing of our power. Folks, if you've connected the dot at this point, now we'll go back to what I've just been covering regarding these land acts and everything else of how the federal courts and the federal government actually started attacking the sovereignty of the states early on in 1860 with Indiana and the other states joining the Union. We're going to connect those dots on Monday so that we can actually show how they got that far out of the bag. I'm G.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the republic review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.